Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters across the world, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and questions that parents face in the Islamic upbringing of their children. Our answers today are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Reza Shahri. And to help us with our questions, we have our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom. As always, it's very nice to have you here, Brother Miqdad. Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much.
So following up on our previous episodes, we were talking about alternatives to using aggression, beating our children for discipline. What alternatives, Brother Miqdad, can you offer the parents?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we talked about and described discipline as a way to control a child's behavior. What's very interesting is that we need to realize that in Islamic upbringing, when we talk about upbringing, we're talking about an inner change. And this happens from within. It happens from by changing a child's likes and dislikes and motivations, inner motivations to do certain things, right? So there's one way where you take an adult, okay? Let's start with an adult. There's one way we tell you put an adult in a prison and say, because you're between four walls, you can't do any bad things anymore, right? That's one option. The other option is that you can take an adult and change what he likes and what he doesn't like to do, right? And make him, or actually train him to like doing good things, and train him to dislike doing bad things, right? Such a person, you can put him in any circumstance, in any situation, and this person will act in a good way because he likes to do good things, right? His inside is such that he's a pure man inside, he's a pure woman inside, that actually only likes to do good things and only likes to do the right thing and avoid doing bad things. This is called tarbiyah. This is called change from within, basically. This is what Islam talks about. This is what the prophets came for. The prophets didn't come to put people in prison and say, I'm going to physically ensure that we have a system in place to make sure that nobody disobeys Allah and everybody has to obey Allah. This wasn't the role of the prophets or the tarbiyah that the Ahlul Bayt did. The Ahlul Bayt came and actually changed us from within. They gave us knowledge. They gave us a worldview. They brought love in our hearts for that which is good and that which is perfect, in a way that from within you're motivated to do good things. If you look at the people in Karbala, for example, those who gave their lives for Imam Hussein, there was no force whatsoever to stay there. On the other side, those people who were in the opposite army, they were given bribes of money. They were told that if you don't come, your family will be tortured back home, your house will be taken, etc. Over here, Imam Hussein told them, you know, you guys go. Okay, you're safe. Forget this world. In the hereafter, I won't even come and ask you why didn't you stay, because I myself am telling you to go. But they stayed. They stayed and they're ready to sacrifice and do the right thing. Why? Out of love and out of wanting to do the right thing. So when we talk about tarbiyah, we're talking about an inner change. And this is what we want in our children as well. That we want to train our children. We want to allow this growth of the child to happen in a way that children actually like to do good things. Children actually want to do good things. They're actually motivated towards saying the truth, towards behaving, speaking politely, towards being respectful to others, towards praying namaz, towards wearing the hijab. The thing that you want them to do from inside, not that you have to force them or bribe them or punish them or hit them. This is not what Islam talks about in upbringing.
Okay, we're going to take a break now, but we'll be back after the break to further our discussion. Stay tuned.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic upbringing. We're talking about alternatives to beating our children. So just before the break, Brother Maghdad, you explained that when it comes to Islamic upbringing and when it comes to the message of the prophets and the mission of the Imams, alayhim salam, it's all about wanting to do good. It's all about change from within. And the message that I got, correct me if I'm wrong, is that when we resort to beating our children, then we're defeating the goal of change from within. That a child wants to do good, wants to behave, but they're only behaving because they're feared of the repercussions. Am I going the right way? And if I am, can you please continue explaining that?
That's correct. So basically, fear is not the main tool that you want to have to bring change, basically. If you want a child to pray, you can use fear and you can use reward as well. So you can use greed and you can use fear. You can say, if you pray, or if you say the truth, or if you speak politely, I'll buy you an ice cream. Right, you've used greed to draw out an action. Or you can say, if you don't pray or if you don't speak politely, then I'll hit you, or I'll punish you, or I'll take away your video game night, for example. Now you've used fear to bring about an action. These two, okay, although we need them at times, although there are places where they should be used and are used, definitely. However, the ultimate goal that we should have, the ultimate tool that we want to use, is inner change. Is that we want them to like to pray. We want them to love to be respectful. We want them to really want from within to speak nicely.
So we have to do this in a way when, first of all, they're not fearing anything. And secondly, it's not because they just want to reward something rewarding.
Yeah. And this is why when these children, they will grow up, when there's no more reward and there's no more fear because my parents are not there anymore, I'm at university all alone, my first year at college, those children who have grown up liking to do good things will stay on the straight path. But those who are on the carrot and stick at home, once the carrot and stick is not there anymore, it's first year of college, then they go all out. And they actually can go and move away from the Sirat al-Mustaqim, from the true path, because they don't have any likeness towards it.
Coming from a religious community myself, most of the children who grew up in my generation were discouraged from bad behavior by scaring them about the Day of Judgment, Qiyamah, and the punishments in hell, basically. So what the main drive, the primary driver for them not to misbehave was the fear from hell. Yet they grew up to remain fearful. How is this different to the kind of punishment that you're seeing, the carrot and stick that you're talking about?
See, if you introduce the hellfire too early in a child's life, then it's actually going to have negative consequences because it's introducing God and the reality as something very scary. And these individuals, these adults, will be always anxious, although many a times, for example, as you mentioned, they will be prevented from doing bad things, right? Because at the end of the day, it's a fear that's actually real fear as well, right? The hellfire is actually a reality, so it's a real fear, and it's fitri, we know it within us, right? But it, at some point, prohibits growth from happening, right? It prohibits from understanding realities that are beyond that. At the end of the day, we have to understand that the hellfire is the reality of our own actions, right? It's not an external fire that comes and burns you, right? As if you put your hand on the stove, for example. No, it's actually the reality of your own actions that burns from within.
Okay. Sorry, I'm going to have to stop you there for a break, but we're going to continue that question after the break. Don't go away.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're talking about the negative effects of beating your children. And just before the break, you were talking about how we shouldn't use the carrot and stick method, because once the carrot and the stick are ineffective when children grow up, then they're going to abandon everything that they've been taught. Before the break, I asked you about how religious children are, a lot of times, they are threatened by being punished in hell, and how that differs from the stick and carrot phenomena. You explained that, first of all, the punishment from hell comes from the actions within, and they remain with us. And you disagreed with introducing the notion of hell too early to children. Now, the Quran uses this method a lot. It scares its readers from hell and God's punishment a lot. You might argue and say that this is only for grown-ups. I just want to make sure. Are you disagreeing with that method, or is that method just for grown-ups? How come the Quran is using it all the time?
Let me rephrase. So I mentioned it, I mentioned it this way, that the carrot and the stick, basically, so reward and punishment, are tools that we have to use them. We will be using them, right? And we do that all the time, right? My point was that the ultimate tool that we want to use, okay, or the real change that will happen, okay, is when it comes from within, okay? When it comes from love and attraction, when it comes from understanding the reality. And if you look at the Quran, it's the same way as well, that when it talks about fear and reward, yes, there is this perspective of bring about fear that you don't go towards a sin, or rewards that you go towards an action. So these are motivations that are out there, right? There are, because at the end of the day, you require them in any society, at a social level, or in a family, at a family level, or even with our own selves, right? You sometimes reward yourself with a coffee, for example, or you punish yourself with anything, for example. These are motivations that are there. But if you look at the Quran itself, you find that Allah uses reality to train us to understand reality and tells us go towards this reality. When He tells us that, when He explains to us about the reality of the human being, that the human being is able to reach Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that the human being has ilm of the reality out there, that
knowledge
he can be
reality.
The knowledge of reality, that he can be the khalifa of Allah, right? That he can have wilayah over other things as well and be under the wilayah of Allah, right? That if you look at the maqam and the station of the Prophet, exactly telling us that this is the reality that you need to, that you want to achieve. So by understanding this reality, you're motivated to do a particular thing, knowing the truth out there, knowing the reality out there, and you're attracted towards these perfections, right? Allah in the Holy Quran constantly introduces Himself. This is who Allah is. These are the traits of perfection, whether it's generosity, whether it's ilm, whether it's life itself, whether it's strength and power, whether it's kindness. All these things are traits of perfection that man, when he hears that, he wants to go closer to that. He wants to adopt them from himself. And so when he does this, actually he's motivated by what? By an attraction towards that which is real. And this is where the concept of love comes through, that you're trained. Allah says there's one way where you worship me because you're fearful, or you worship me because you want reward. But the best of worship is what? When you love me. That means because you're from within, you want what's real. From within you want that which is perfection. And therefore Allah was trying to do your upbringing towards love of the perfection.
And that's the feeling that we should try to evoke in our children.
Definitely.
We're very over time, but I really didn't want to cut you short on that nice response. If you missed the program, don't worry. You can always download an archive of this episode and our previous episodes. Simply visit www.parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com. And find us on the Call of Islam radio page. You can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. And until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Ahway, where on this week's show we'll be taking a look at the economy of India, paying particular attention to a series of protests and strikes that have hit the agriculture sector following three controversial new farming laws passed by the Indian government. So, what are these three laws? Well, first up is the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Act, designed to allow electronic trading and e-commerce of goods. It also prevents state governments from levying any market fees. Now, next up is what's called the Farmers Agreement on Price Assurance and Farm Services Act. It's aimed to create a framework for contract farming through an agreement between farmer and buyer prior to the production of any goods. And the third and the final law is called the Essential Commodities Act, and this allows for the center to regulate certain food items in the course of extraordinary circumstances such as war, drought, or famine. Now, we'll obviously go into more detail throughout the show, but why don't you have your say on the topic? Are you a farmer in India? How have the new laws affected you? So let's head into more detail on this subject on our first report, looking into just what started the protests and just how seriously New Delhi is taking the farmers' concerns.
It's been labeled as the so-called world's largest democracy and has the world's second largest population, hosting an array of religions, languages, and cultures. But one thing that's common across the country of India is its reliance on agriculture to sustain its huge population. So when the government of India decided to pass three new laws covering farmers and agricultural rules and regulations, the farmers took to the streets in their tens of thousands to protest the bills, voicing concerns over their rights and livelihoods. The Indian government, however, has argued that the three new laws will give farmers more freedom, but the vast majority of farmers, many of whom hold small freeholds, are concerned that the prices of their goods will be driven down and that the laws have no caveats in place to protect them should things go wrong.
70% of the rural households are engaged in agriculture in India. So that tells you that there is a huge, huge population which is dependent on agriculture, whose livelihood is dependent on agriculture.
With many farmers coming from rural areas in India, agriculture is more than just a livelihood. It's a way of life that supports them and their families, depending heavily on the land that they produce on. So why then did the Indian government choose to change the current rules?
So what Modi has done is, from two points of view, it is interesting. One is it's more equitable in the sense that small farmers and large farmers can all sell to the private sector and have the private sector price, rather than the large farmers taking on the large-scale sales at the minimum security price. And that's one thing. And the second thing he has told them is to have what is called as contract farming. That is, some of the companies would give them fertilizers and various other things that they need, machinery, equipment, and give them a guaranteed price and buy from the farmers. And the third thing he has said is consolidation. That is, there are very small farms, and they're not very productive, and the large farmers gain everything and they lose. So what he's trying to do is to consolidate.
There are also concerns about the lack of consultation by the government with the farmers, with one of the major concerns being that prior to the law being passed, farmers were assured prices via a scheme called the Minimum Support Pricing, or the MSP. This covered farmers should prices fall dramatically, ensuring that their livelihoods were not damaged. With the new law appearing to severely hamper the welfare of one of the poorest deciles of people in the country, it hence becomes clear as to why so many Indian farmers are converging on Delhi, coining the popular slogan, Dili Chayo, or Let's Go Delhi, where the farmers can put their concerns to the people in the heart of the government. As things stand, though, it seems that some of the pressure has paid off, as India's Supreme Court has temporarily suspended the law going into practice, and leaving the corridors of power in Delhi forced to go back to the drawing board with some new ideas.
Joining me in the studio now is Atif Padidar. We're also joined by Suma Threya, a professor of technology strategy from the University of Essex. Her main field of interest lies in the economics of innovation and international economics, and she has published over 50 papers on these topics. Professor, many thanks for joining us here on Economic Divide.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, Professor, first up, Indian farmers, they're protesting about these new laws that's passed by the government. You have many rural people who rely on agriculture in India. Do you think this rule can be overturned due to the resistance that is being met?
I don't think they can be really overturned, but the protests are legitimate in the sense that it's going to cause a lot of distress in the farming population. The reason they can't be overturned is political and economic. The political reasons are, of course, that the Supreme Court has constituted a committee, the members of which have already expressed their support for the farm laws. The economic imperative is that there has to be a mechanism to transfer agricultural land to industrial uses. In every country that this happens, starting from the UK, it has been problematic. You know, Thomas Hardy wrote about it. We have the works of Tolstoy. In Russia and China, these programs were achieved through large-scale collectivization missions. So in every case, it has not ever been easy to transfer this land, but in a way, the long-term growth of the economy depends on the less productive sector giving way to the more productive sector. And agriculture's role in the Indian economy is shrinking. This just shows you that there are other sectors more productive and contributing more to the economy.
Okay, Atif has some interesting points that are raised there by Professor Athreya there. Do you think that there are any advantages to these new laws that have been passed? For example, the ability for the farmers to sell directly to the buyers without a middleman? Or do you think that these rural farmers in particular are just too isolated from the sale process in order to be able to take advantage of these so-called reforms?
Well, on paper, yes. The government wants to make the agricultural system much more modernized. It wants to give the farmers independence and eliminate the monopoly of mandis, the middleman between farmers and actual buyers. But mandis have been in this business since 1964. They are too powerful, especially in northern parts of India, like Punjab, where we saw the most intense protests. So I don't think that they can eliminate their role. And at the same time, what the government is offering is not like eliminating mandis. They're creating new middlemen. But what the farmers need is reforms, not new laws. So in reality, what they're offering is not practical, but in on paper, it looks good.
All right, thanks so much for that. Interesting points also that you make. And also thanks to the professor, both of whom will be back with us shortly. Right now, it's a good time to take a look at how the impact of the COVID-19 virus has hit the world's second largest populous country and ascertain just how the vaccine rollout will be delivered to over 1.3 billion people in our next report.
Touched on the huge population of India, yet it seems that with a growing birth rate, the country's headcount is predicted to pass the population of China by the year 2026, making India the most populous nation on Earth. As the world's fifth largest economy, one could argue that having the largest population in the world is no big deal, as until now, India appears to have fared rather well. However, the arrival of the COVID-19 virus has taken its toll on India and brings with it one of the world's largest logistical challenges, namely distributing a vaccine to over 1.3 billion people, spread out in vast towns and cities, slums, and of course rural areas in India. With 10.5 million people in India infected with the virus and over 152,000 deaths, the loss of life is not the only issue affecting the nation. The impact on the economy has also taken its toll. But just how heavy has the impact been?
India has lost about $154 billion, according to some of the estimates that have been given, or 7% of GDP, which is quite high. And that's the economic impact. And most of the jobs have been lost, mostly in the services sector, not the IT and all that, but other services, mostly tourism, hotels, and that kind of stuff. And apart from that, most of these people who were employed in the service sector were from the rural areas. And now they're going back. 23 million to 40 million people are going back from the urban areas or to rural areas because there are no jobs because of the COVID. All is shut up and therefore the shops are shut and there's no business. And so they're going back.
But India has taken a bold leap in fighting the virus and has started what is essentially the world's largest vaccination program, hoping to vaccinate the first 300 million people by August, starting with frontline workers and the elderly. However, not all may be as rosy as the plan sounds, as reports taken from a survey of 8,000 Indians found that 69% of them are hesitant about taking the vaccination, which equated to over two-thirds of those asked, raising the question as to just how India will be able to persuade everyone to take part. With India still recovering from the 7.5% loss on their GDP between July and September of 2020, and dealing with a lockdown that cost around $26 billion, the financial impact on the country is one that may take some time to resolve, with the Indian government forced to cough up an initial bailout of 348 billion Indian rupees, which equates to around $4.75 billion, still a far cry from the amount of money being lost from the impact of the virus. What now remains to be seen is just how fast and how effectively India can deliver its vaccine rollout, and following this, just how long it takes for India to get back up and running again to pre-pandemic levels.
We're joined now back in the studio with Professor Suma Athreya from the University of Essex. Professor, India having the world's second largest population, obviously there's a challenge when it comes to, for example, the financial costs and the logistical distribution of the vaccine, the COVID-19 vaccine. How do you think the Indian government will afford and actually execute this huge task, which has started already?
Let me come to the execution first, which I think is a lesser problem, because over the 1960s and 70s, because of the programs to eradicate smallpox and polio, India has actually a very good vaccine infrastructure, which is made up of primary healthcare centers, district-level healthcare centers, a lot of civil society and, you know, religious organizations that have penetrated into areas which are not covered by the PHC or the DHCs. And the present government has also put this whole network together on the web. You know, they've created this thing called Ayush, which basically links up all the different networks in the country that can push vaccines. So in terms of the ability to deliver and execute a vaccination program, I think this is a well developed competence, and I think they'll do that quite easily. How will they pay for it? I don't know. The Indian economy has shrunk by 26%, which means the revenues are very, very small with the central government. And also in India, the health is a state subject.
Okay. I would think also just getting people the vaccine itself, or for them to come to centers where the vaccine is applied. Well, also for the whole world is racing to get the vaccine out to their people, obviously, as soon as possible, challenge in itself. But with India having such a huge land surface, something I just talked about, as well as you have remote locations all over the place, in a sense, do you think that the sheer scale of the operation itself will see first the richer areas of India to have advantages over the poorer areas?
Definitely. India is one of the most unequal countries in the world, and we saw the true face of inequality during this pandemic, when people in the poor areas, ethnic minorities and poverty-stricken neighborhoods were struggling with this pandemic, getting infected and dying from this virus. People in the privileged areas and rich families managed to stay away from danger. So I think after doctors, first responders, and medical workers get vaccinated, it would be the rich people who would be lining up to get vaccinated, and God knows when people in the less privileged areas, cities and slums are going to get the chance to get vaccinated.
Well, many thanks for that, Atafi. Appreciate it. Okay, also thanks to the professor. Right now we're going to take a quick break here on Economic Divide. Don't go anywhere as the discussion will continue. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kaba Tapwe. Time now to take a deeper look at our main story in our in-depth section. India relies heavily on farming as a source of both income and sustenance. In fact, 70% of rural households depend primarily on agriculture for their livelihoods, with 82% of farmers operating small-scale farms. But the farming folk are still amongst some of the poorest people in India. Now, the wealth gap, in fact, in India is large, in particular when it comes to income inequality. The richest 10% of Indians own 80.7% of the wealth, with the trend heading in an upward direction on a yearly basis, with rural farmers feeling the pinch more than most. Now, one of the reasons for the growing gap, particularly for farmers, is the steady decline in agriculture in India. Over the last few years, the decline has been as much as 50%, which has meant that the contribution to the national GDP has fallen from 34% in 1984 to just 16% in the year 2020. Employment has also been affected by the decline in agriculture, with around 81% of Indians employed within the sector in the year 1983 to around 58% in the year 2018, and still falling, with India turning ever more towards the service sector. It seems that retraining and education will be a future priority for the rural civic authorities. In contrast to the decline in the agricultural sector, the facilities management market, well, it has grown 17% in the last 5 years, surpassing even U.S.'s $19 billion mark, supported in part by a booming real estate, retail, and hospitality industry surge. Well, it's time now to take a look at our final package today, looking at how India is competing with China on a regional scale and why it pulled out of what's called the RCEP.
With such an important regional geographical position, trade in India is something that spanned the sands of time, and hence why so many nations were keen to have control over the country, hence justifying why the British, for one, called India the jewel in the crown when it came to their empire. Yet fast forward to modern day times, and India, as a trading nation, is placed in an even more interesting place, namely, trying to compete with its northern neighbour, China, a competition that's heated up to rumours of tension and conflict between the two. There's also tension on India's northwestern front with Pakistan, with both Islamabad and Delhi locked in a nuclear security dilemma, with both nations enjoying a nuclear deterrence that thankfully until now has remained just that, a deterrent. But when it comes to trade and partnerships, India chose recently not to enter a pact that would have seen it as part of the world's largest free trade deal, namely the RCEP. However, it only pulled out at the last second, raising the question as to just exactly why this was the case.
It's China that they're worried about. That is, China's exports will increase to India and the domestic industry will suffer. That is, the domestic firms will go down. And even though India brought down the tariff rates and quotas in 1991 with Manmohan Singh's liberation policies, it still prevails. The domestic industry is still protected in several of the areas. And they're quite worried if they enter into this agreement and there'll be free trade and the Chinese will really export even more and the domestic industry will suffer.
According to the International Trade Center located in Geneva, India is a member of the Asia-Pacific Trade Agreement, the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, and the World Trade Organization, offering the country some incentives. It's also struck mini deals and free trade agreements with a host of regional nations, such as the Maldives, South Korea, and Bangladesh. Yet India seems to prefer to avoid large pacts and continue to trade with its tried and trusted trading partners from the UK, the US, and the EU, hence probably the reason it chose not to join the RCEP, as many would claim that the deal only benefited China, which, as we know, is India's largest economic and regional geopolitical competitor.
Back again with us is Atif Paridar and our special guest, Professor Suma Athreya. Professor, India has chosen not to join the RCEP, but regional economic pacts have proven to work in the past, like the EU or NAFTA. Do you think that India may one day actually join an international or regional economic bloc, and what are the advantages and disadvantages?
So the classic economic position on this is that the regional bloc is a form of collective protectionism, and it makes sense to join the regional bloc if your trade creation from joining the bloc is going to be greater than the trade diversion from existing structures of trade. And from this perspective, you have to ask, well, does India already have a lot of trade with the REC countries? And the answer is no, it doesn't have this trade. You could say, okay, it doesn't have this trade, but it might develop this trade over time. And again, here, it's not very clear that that can happen. So India's prominent trading partners are actually the Middle Eastern countries and the US and Europe. Those are very big trading partners. China has become important in recent years. About 10% of imports come from China. But it's not clear that China cannot be substituted by other countries, or that joining the REC will give India a very big advantage on Chinese imports. In any case, as you know, there are other geopolitical concerns, you know, China and India having some border issues at the moment. And the last thing that the government wants is to seen as allowing China to enter and take it over economically.
Well, Atif, in our previous episode on Economic Divide, we did cover the RCEP, many people claiming that the deal actually just benefited China. Do you think that that is the main reason that India chose not to sign this deal, which happened at the last minute, from what we understand, and then prefer to actually continue trade deals with its more traditional partners instead, like the one our guest mentioned?
Well, there's no doubt that China is the main player in the RCEP deal, but it has guaranteed to help its partners, especially during this pandemic. It has the power, resources, and the experience to do so. What prevented India from getting involved in RCEP was not the fact that China was the main player. India didn't want to upset the United States,
As we know, China and the United States has been engaged in a trade war for the past couple of years. And Narendra Modi wanted to get closer to the United States since he took office. But what he didn't predict was the fact that maybe Donald Trump couldn't get reelected. And we have to see how he's going to manage this crisis, because he lost the RCEP, China, and now he lost the support of Donald Trump.
Sure, indeed. That's going to be trying times for India, it appears, at this point anyways. Okay, many thanks to Atif Apadidar and also Professor Suma Athreya for their valuable thoughts and for their contributions to this program. Time now to take a look at our popular news section, 1,000 Words. India, with its large and diverse population, is well on the way to becoming a contender as one of the world's largest economies, particularly as the service sector gathers pace across the country. However, it appears that as technology and the desire for innovation grows, the tendency to forget the more rural areas and poor populations in the country is leaving many people discontent with the way things are going. With farmers protesting across the nation at the new laws being passed, it seems that India is on the tipping point as to where it's going to go next. Does it modernize and advance, or stick with tradition and risk losing out to global and regional competitors like China? I'm sure you will all agree there are some tough choices on the horizon for the Indian government. That's about all the time we have for this episode. I'd like to thank all my guests for joining me on the show. On behalf of myself, Kavit Ahway, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
Thank you.
برادران، خواهران، عزیزانی که میاید پیش من میگید
Sometimes our dear brothers and sisters come to us and ask why our prayers are not answered. The answer to the question is in Ayah 11 of Surah Al-Isra, which states, Man prays for ill as avidly as he prays for good, and man is overhasty. The main theme of this ayah is that sometimes the human beings hasten in order to get the answer to their supplications. However, they don't know that they must not hasten to get the answer to their prayers and that they must be more patient. This haste of them will give them ill instead of good. Maybe the answer to their request is not given soon, but there is goodness in that answer for them later. Therefore, we must not hasten in getting the answers to our prayers and requests from Allah, and we must be more patient so that our prayers are answered on the right place and right time. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRibe English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The recent events in France and similar ones in some other Western countries have convinced me to directly talk to you about them. A letter for you.
And this is a letter written by the leader of the Muslim Ummah.
Special program on the message of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei to the youth in Europe and North America.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum wa rahmatullah, my fellow Muslim brothers and sisters across the globe. Welcome to today's segment of A Letter for You. I am your host for today. My name is Zainab, and I'm very thankful to be with you guys today. In this studio with me, I have two guests, two gentlemen, which are present here today to share aspects of their thoughts on a very important matter that is quite a hot subject of the day. The letter of the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the youth of Europe and North America. Inshallah ta'ala, this is going to be an interesting one. Gentlemen, would you please introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. My name is Wahid, and I'm from Sweden, and I'm studying Islamic studies, religion, and Islamic denominations in Qom.
Thank you so very much for being with us, Brother Wahid.
Assalamu alaikum. My name is Muhammad Reza. I'm from Qom, but I've lived in Houston for several years, for about 10 years. And right now I'm studying at college, and I'm majoring in English teaching methodology.
There's going to be much more. Stay tuned. This is going to be fascinating. We are just a bunch of young people, and we're going to talk about our own personal opinions, basically, on the Supreme Leader's letter to the Western youth. Nothing technical, nothing fancy. We just want to know how we felt about the letter, our feedbacks, our thoughts. Because basically, well, every one of us have experience of living in the Western world. So we're just going to share our ideas on it, basically, inshallah. Guys, have you read the letter, by the way?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah, I've read it several times. I thought it was very nice, but it was very enlightening at the same time. That's my opinion. What do you guys think?
We think a lot.
I think as a person who has lived in the West, it's exactly the thing that we have tried to say for so many years,
mm-hmm.
and people are not listening to us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as a person who's been there, I know what the people think about Islam.
Yeah.
And how Islam is being stereotyped as a religion which, you know, is like endorses terrorism and is a violent, barbaric religion. We have been trying to tell the people, for example, the Americans, that, okay, you see, Islam is not the Islam that you're seeing on TV.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the Islam that, for example, you watch on the news.
Which is exactly what the letter is trying to imply.
Yeah, exactly. They're giving a very bad image of Islam
mm-hmm.
in the media.
Maybe we should do less talking and more
action. Do you think Muslims are actually at fault because
walk
of this?
The talk.
I think the person we can blame the most, I think the Arab countries,
mm-hmm.
they're Muslims, you know?
Yeah.
And instead of stopping these terrorism and, you know, all these bloodshed that's taking place, Daesh, they're supporting them.
Yeah, they're fueling it and they're feeding it.
I wouldn't say that, though, brother.
I think
you
it's very
that.
Ironic
okay, we'll
that they're
to.
Supporting Israel and they're supporting the Zionist movement.
Mm. Well, they're
instead
not
of
like
helping,
they're not doing it out in the open. Like they're not yelling out in the streets that, "Oh yeah, we're totally
But everyone
supporting.
Knows, you know, it's
Yeah, I know.
It's
in the
clear
closet.
As daylight.
And maybe we should as I said, talk less and
do
walk
more.
The talk. And,
okay, so how do we actually walk the talk?
It's a very important point here that we don't get in a defensive position, all right? Never get into a defensive position.
Exactly.
It doesn't
I
matter
agree.
If you're in the West or in the East. You never talk in a defensive position when you talk about Islam. If someone has inquiries about Islam, you answer those inquiries. But make sure that practice the teachings of Islam and people will automatically go towards you. And about the Arab countries, well, you know, from another angle, maybe those same Americans that you have more experience with would say that Iran is a major terrorist country
who
helps and aids terrorists. And
but who
maybe
are they
we should
calling
look
terrorists?
At different angles.
You said that perhaps Muslims themselves are at fault.
Yes, most surely.
Most surely.
It's not 100%, but we have a huge fault.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
But I
could
think...
Could you, like, wait, hold on. In which field do you think? Could you, like, set some
In the akhlaqi
example?
Perspective. In the
ethical.
Akhlaqi perspective that our ethics and our morals are not what the Islamic teachings
teach What are they doing
us.
That they shouldn't? What should they do that they're not?
Well, my experience from the West and as a person who has lived there all my life is that when it's about honesty, when it's about business deals,
mm-hmm.
they're more honest. When it's about being on time, you know, these small akhlaqi things or moral things, to be on time, for example, when you see that
Does
fights
really
that
being
go
on time
fights that goes around in the cities mm-hmm. gangs in European cities major European cities we see that mostly there are immigrants involved so yes we have a blame there that we haven't practiced our deen but as I said, it's not 100%. And the Westerners, with their hypocrisy and their foreign policy, have also their fault.
Yeah, I get that. I agree with you on some grounds. But two things. First of all, I don't see how not being on time... Brother Muhammad, you're not stranded, okay? we'll get back to you. First of all, does really not being on time, is it really the reason behind all this Islamophobia?
No.
I'm not on time, so the West hates Muslims.
No, I mentioned like three examples.
Just one example.
I know. First question.
I mentioned three examples.
No, because you're saying that we're at fault.
Those are things that we shouldn't minimize.
Mm-mm. Back to the letter. What moralities, Brother Muhammad, I'm asking you first, okay? What moralities, what points of morality do you think was in the letter that would have some sort of a positive effect on a Western youth?
There's one thing I remember. It was about Prophet Muhammad and how... Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And how he said that Ayatollah Khamenei, he pointed out that Prophet Muhammad is the prophet of mercy. Rahmatul lil alamin. He is mercy. How he said that, okay, I ask you, dear youth, to go and research about Islam and the Prophet of Mercy yourselves. Don't look at what the Westerners and America and
the media,
the West, is saying about Islam.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, he says that I don't even expect you to, like, pick up my studies of Islam or anyone else's. Go find your own Islam.
Yeah, exactly.
Just let go of what the media is feeding you.
But go to the original sources.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He doesn't say that, okay, we have the best form of Islam in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
You should come and see what kind of Islam we have in Iran.
He talks as a scholar, not a politician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. He was completely objective.
Mm-hmm.
He was not subjective.
There's one point
that's very valuable.
Yes, indeed it was. It was.
And it's very influential as well.
When I talked about the fault of Muslims, now I want to go over to the part where the Westerners have their fault. And we see that in the letter that Ayatollah Khamenei wrote, he says that, "Here I don't want to deal with the different phobias with which the Western nations have thus far been indoctrinated. A hasty review of recent critical studies of history would bring home to you the fact that the Western government's insincere and hypocritical treatment of other nations and cultures has been censored in the new historiographies."
And that was quote unquote, by the way.
Yeah. Thank you for that. So we see here that the leader himself points out the problems that the Western governments and their mass media and their tools have indoctrinated the generations that have come and will come with these phobias that Islam is a threat. And before that, it was the communist and so on and so forth. And he points out their fault.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, guys, so we have basically almost roughly approximately 4 minutes left. Brother Muhammad, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Brother Wahid. If you think that Muslims themselves are at fault also, what are their faults?
I think one of the mistakes that Muslims, they're making is that they're getting too much involved in the Shia-Sunni issue.
Yes.
You know, instead of being united, instead of like trying to achieve unity among each other, they get themselves into the issue of Shia and Sunni.
Yes.
So this is a waste of time, and
absolutely,
this is exactly
what the enemy wants.
So this is just one of their mistakes.
I would like
this
to
is
say
a major mistake.
I would like to say that most the Muslim youth in the West, they don't even know their own deen. How would they know what Sunni is and what Shia is? That's number one.
No, the problem is that
when we look at the criminal rate, especially in Europe,